technology increasingly affecting every aspect of our lives, it's important to understand how it affects us psychologically. Welcome to the Psychology of Technology podcast, where we look at how humans and machines collide.
And welcome to the Psychology of Technology with myself, Kareem Tawansi, and my wonderful friend, Mr.
Good morning, Brett Raven here. Thank you.
How are you today, Brett?
Feeling pretty good, actually. It's a nice sunny day outside. I'm really enjoying the weather this time of year.
Yes. You know, I was thinking the other day that September is a nice place to be in most parts of the world. It's either spring or autumn. In most parts of the world, it's still quite nice.
Yeah. Back in Canada, this time of year is when the leaves start to change color. It's beautiful in certain spots. And then the wheels fall off around October and gets very cold and miserable. So.
Right. But presumably at this time, it's still quite warm?
Yeah. Well, yes. They usually have Indian summer, they call it, this time of the year. So they get a bit of a last warmth blast through.
Yeah.
And then it starts to get cooler and the leaves change and then it starts to fall apart.
And I can tell you that's good news for people whose birthday is in September.
That's correct.
I'm just saying.
Especially people turning 75 this year. It's impressive.
75. I just want to remind you of one thing. You're only 1 year younger than me, so whatever slurs you throw my way, just subtract one.
No, I've stopped aging, actually. I was my age.
Really? Can't see it from the outside. So today, I thought we'd have a bit of a discussion about the pain of legacy. Legacy is everywhere. I was watching a video the other day about RPA, robotic process automation, and that is one avenue to modernizing a legacy environment. But in reality, all you're doing is sort of putting a new coat of paint over something that's still quite old. And I get that that probably makes sense if you've got legacy systems that are 25, 30 years old and you've got hundreds of thousands or millions of customers using it every day. Depending on the value of the system, it's probably a good stopgap measure, but at the end of the day, nothing beats the advantages of a new system. And so one of the things that I've been thinking about, and I suppose this kind of carries on from what we talked about with the customer experience, is in an environment where customers are getting less patient with friction and have more choice, I think every organization has a responsibility to provide the best customer experience. And there's no way around having systems that support that. And I'll give you an example. The other day I started using a system from my phone carrier provider. And you could tell that it was based on legacy. Even though the interface was modern, it didn't work, it took forever, and it was a terrible experience. And I think if I was going into the market now to find a new telco, I would definitely take that into account. And same with the banks. If you think about Australia has what they call the four pillar banks, I think they call them, the four big banks.
Yep.
And I have had accounts with three of those four in the last, say, 5 to 10 years. One of them stands way ahead of the rest in terms of its technological experience because about 8 years ago they started to invest in upgrading their systems.
Mm.
And so if I was to choose, be looking for a new bank, I would definitely probably put that at the top of my list. Now, having said all of that, I know that in your various roles you've had, well, I'm going to use the word pleasure, but I don't really mean it in its literal sense, the pleasure of modernizing some systems. And I know that you've kind of gone through some pain around that. So maybe you could talk me through.
Sure. So rather than calling it legacy, I call it tech debt.
Yep.
Because I think that becomes a bit more poignant, especially for people like CFOs who really start to understand the concept of something that is actually costing you money when you don't repair it or fix it. There's been multiple times. You and I have been in this industry for over 30 years now. I hate to remind us and our two listeners. you build something, it goes into production, you tweak it, you maintain it for a little while, then it sits there for 5 or 10 years and becomes a pain eventually. And then, as you say, using something like RPA to put a lipstick on a pig is an interesting approach for the short term, but the long-term approach or the long-term impact will be quite damaging, potentially. So, look, one of the ways I look at this is that debt exists for a reason, that debt exists because it was either a good system that you built and you spent a lot of time thinking about it, and you've built it in a custom way, more than likely, to fit the business for the purpose at the time. The technique I try and look at going into the future is how do we, rather than trying to rebuild something from scratch all over again, how do you leverage that asset, sweat the asset, I think they used to call it back in the 80s, to make sure that you're not just starting from zero and having to wait 6 months, 12 months to build a system that replaces it or more and investing millions of dollars without getting any benefit from it. So one of the approaches that I've taken in the past that seems to be fairly successful is the strangler vine method. So there's a guy named Martin Fowler who's a pretty prominent and well-respected architect in the whole, I think he's Microsoft.net space. And he has this technique that is a pretty common thing. You probably use it in your business as well, which is you have this old system, you start building a new system side by side, and eventually one by one you start taking features over. So eventually what happens is you build this new system up, the old system starts to decommission, say module or feature or function at a time, and before you know it, you've replaced the old system with the new system. So that seems to be the most pragmatic way for a lot of your enterprise type applications that you end up working with, or things that you've built in the past. It doesn't always work that way, and there's always a cost benefit, I think. When you're looking at it from a business owner's perspective, if you have an opportunity to spend $1 million on RPA on a system that would cost you $100 million to replace, probably makes sense for the next few years, but eventually it's going to give out. So using the strangler vine approach, I think, is a way for you to shore up against what your legacy investment was and continue to extract value from it, at the same time modernizing the interface and modernizing the experience. Because ultimately, the customer experience is, as you said, paramount. And one of the things that I try and keep remind myself is the customer is not just the end user, not just a consumer. So from a bank's perspective, you're the customer for a bank, but there's also internal customers, employees, and there's myriads of different roles within a bank that need to be taken care of. So the last thing you want to do is just look after your customer and have the employees be miserable using an old system.
Mm. That's interesting. I just got to talk a little bit about RPA before we get back into the way forward. RPA is an interesting concept in the sense that I think they had a great promise. I mean, RPA has been around for nearly 30 years with screen scraping, etc., but now it's a lot more technologically advanced, although I think it still probably follows some of the old principles. I think a lot of people kind of go into an RPA project thinking that they can replace FTEs with an automated process, but what ends up happening is it takes so much energy and time just to get one person's job automated that it doesn't hit the mark, so to speak. And I think there are some, they call, what's the right word for it, mixed models where you have a automated process sitting alongside a human and they work together. And I think that does give you better results. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I think, as you said, that's just technical debt you have to sometime pay for. So along the lines of embarking on a new project, do you have any views around architecture? And for example, what's your views on microservices and how do they fit into the grand picture of things?
Yep. So kind of going back to your RPA model, for example, RPA tends to be a poor man's API, in my view. And as you say, it creates tech debt, and eventually over time that's going to become worn and it doesn't necessarily live up to the promise. So if you're doing a poor man's API, eventually you're going to have to build a proper API at some point. So microservices or any kind of services approach, microservices was in fashion and still is relevant in many ways, but I think it's becoming a bit more of a macro service approach in some organizations. So rather than having a single service that has a single repository and a single purpose, you may have a collection of services on a single repository and single set of service base.
Right.
It's much easier for you to manage from a deployment perspective. You can still have a team focused on a group of features rather than an individual feature. Now, it doesn't necessarily fit every business, but I think that's the kind of thing that is happening more now, where if you're replacing a legacy system, you take the API approach, a services-based approach, and again, you can use a strangler vine approach. You can have a system that sits there, you access its data repository and potentially some logic, you build alongside it an API interface, API gateway perhaps, and that exposes the capability of that old system into what you're going to be building in new. So I think it allows you to move more quickly that way. I think RPA, as you said, it's more of a stopgap. And if you're doing that poor man API approach, I think that's going to cause more grief in the future than I think it might be worth.
And so from a design perspective, how tightly coupled do you think, say, a team that's working on transformation or modernization should work with the existing system and the existing processes?
I think there's two schools of thought to this, to be honest. I think there is benefit of having people who are part of the legacy team, potentially, to be able to bring on the knowledge of the data model and the logic that is required to operate that system. Sometimes it's dangerous to have those people involved too heavily in a project because they'll just steer you back in the direction of the legacy application. So I think there's a purpose for it. And if you use that group as subject matter experts rather than necessarily at front of design, then that'll unstick the ability to innovate in that new platform. So keeping them separate, I think, is a good idea. I think you've seen the Spotify squads model, which is basically creating combined teams that focus on a specific feature. And that combined team may be database architects, you know, lead developers, backend developers, UX people, product managers, and so on. So squads can get created in order to focus on a specific area. So within a squad, you may have somebody who's the legacy SME who can answer questions on why things were done a certain way, what the data model looks like, and why, you know, what improvements we could be making on it, and so on. So I think there's a good argument for a slight mixture. But again, if you want to run at pace and you want to be truly innovative, I think leaving some of that legacy thinking behind is really important.
So do you think that maybe, and I suppose you're probably already saying this, but just so we're explicit about it, there are those that are leading the redesign capability, and they tend to sit from a customer first perspective. Is that kind of what you're saying? So so they're looking at the experience first, forgetting about the legacy.
That's right.
And then bringing back to a home base what the customer wants and coming up with designs around that. And then on the other side, you've got those with the legacy knowledge, the SMEs as you call it. And then at some point you want to bring them together. Is that how you how you see it?
Yeah.
And then of course you're going to have two different mindsets. So what's your views on harmonizing that? Who has the ultimate say, the modernization group or the legacy group?
I think it comes down to product management, proper like technology-based product management. So I've seen this more successful in the past 5 years than I had in my previous 25 years in the job, where you appoint somebody who becomes the advocate for the customer's experience. They are a product manager, let's call them.
Yep.
They will work heavily with user experience designers, UI, look and feel, even the people who do enablement, so training, learning and development, that kind of thing. And I would ultimately say that they should be the ones that kind of drive the design going forward. And then it's really the job of the rest of the team, including the SMEs, to figure out how they bridge the gap between what ultimately the customer wants and needs based on an advocacy perspective and what the system can provide and then how you fill in the gaps in between.
Have you gone through, as a consumer, do you have any examples in your mind of a scenario where you've been using a system and it's been modernized and you've felt it and you've seen it work successfully, say? I suppose in your role within Salesforce, are you often modernizing legacy systems?
Yes, definitely. In fact, even within the business itself, there's been a modernization in the platform that was quite controversial and exciting and, you know, had mixed feelings about it and so on, but it's actually created some big benefits for the customer. So Salesforce was built on, originally they called it Salesforce Classic. Well, we refer to it as Classic now because we have the new Lightning interface. It is a paradigm shift in the way that people use the system. It had to be.
Yeah.
The legacy platform itself, the legacy interface, was functional, but it just looked like it was from the 90s still and really didn't have that ability to be properly, you know, true mobile first, and it had a lot of constraints based on its design. So absolutely, I think the modern approach to design, the modern approach to squad-based, product management-focused, customer-obsessed implementations, it pays off massively. Like there's no question that the experiences that we're having now with new systems, as you said, you know, some banks really get it right.
Yeah.
They've invested heavily 15, 20 years ago in replatforming a lot of their core systems, and it gives them the opportunity then to innovate further, which is why, again, this RPA concept really bothers me. I think if it's horses for courses, as you might say, but unless you open things up into an API-led strategy and then have design-led thinking off the top of that, I think you're kind of hamstringing yourself.
It's funny, on that on the banking example, I still have accounts with two of those banks, probably the one that leads the pack and the one that trails the pack. And the funny thing is, when I use the leading bank system for long enough, I just have an expectation about how it should work, and then I go back to the legacy bank where I have most of my accounts, and I get frustrated by the fact that I can't do it, or the way I do it is so the way I do it is so, I can cut all this out by the way as long as I can learn. cumbersome. I'm going to say it again. So the way I do it is so cumbersome that I find it really, really painful. So I can see how it would make a difference. And I think in the past people were just happy to have systems, but now the system itself can be a draw card for customers or a sticking point for customers, so something to take in mind.
I agree. I think the black box novelty of technology has worn thin over the last, probably the last 15 years, in fact. You know, when we were first in our industry, you could just create any interface and people would just be happy data would be put in front of them and they could enter stuff in and nobody cared, right? And
I've seen some horrendous interfaces. It's like an engineer vomited on the screen. Oh, there you go. And they were so excited about it. But, I mean, it did the job, but it just... it was so ugly to look at, and the experience was terrible.
So I think customers, whether they're external customers or internal customers, their expectations are so much higher now. And, you know, the ubiquity of mobile phones and apps and design around that just gives us more, there's more pressure, really, for the user experience on any system people use to be that much better.
Yeah. And what's interesting, I think, when it comes to sort of design of what I call the views, and there's so many views, but like web, desktop, mobile, voice now and watch is that whole sense of expecting, there's a brand associated, there's an experience that's associated with a brand. And I use Spotify on iOS, Android, desktop app, web, and now I'm using it on watch. And of course, and I talk to it through Google Home. And it's interesting because on all of those platforms, bar the watch, I think the experiences have been very good. The watch experience, they haven't got it right yet, in my opinion. But because that makes sense, because the watch market isn't that big. But it's just interesting to watch a relatively modern company like Spotify, who does a very good job of user experience, if you like, grapple with all the different platforms, because there are so many platforms. And even when it comes to watch, the watch platform, I mean, other than the Apple Watch environment, how many other environments do you have to support? Do you have to support Tizen? Do you have to support Google Wear, which I hear is not being attended to? And then, of course, I think Fitbit has its own and Garmin has its own. So if you are creating apps for those environments, what do you do in terms of user experience? All things that you have to think about when you're launching a project, whether it be a Greenfields project or a modernization of an existing platform. Because since I've purchased my recent watch, since I purchased my watch, I've realized all the things I can and can't do with it. So suddenly I'm kind of going, oh, I can pay and I can read an email, but I can't check my bank balance, or, as I was saying before, my Spotify experience is less pleasant. So I get that there's quite a bit of work to get that done too. And I think one of the things that people who are maybe not in the industry don't necessarily see is the amount of work that needs to happen for what feels like a very simple experience. And also the layers and layers of code that things sit on. And that is probably something that's very difficult to explain, because if you write an app, you're probably writing an app sitting on some form of framework that's sitting on some kind of, I don't know, compiler or executor of some sort that's sitting on some subsystem in an operating system that's then itself sitting on layers of operating system, then that's sitting on various forms of hardware. And the thousands and millions of brains writing code and all those levels have all had to somehow get it all to work together. So it's a pretty amazing feat when you think about it.
It is. I think in commerce, for example, we look at this from what we call an omni-channel perspective. So all the devices you talk about, all the different ways of consuming Spotify, whether it's web or an app on hundreds of devices potentially, we consider those channels to market, basically. So how do you get in front of the customer? So if you think of it from an omni-channel perspective, you're right, below that first layer, the presentation layer, is really complicated because there's so many variables involved. And, you know, everybody... you know, every few years a new standard comes out like PWA or AMP or HTML5, even if you go back further, as a way to try and create a bit more ubiquity, like flatten the platform effectively so you can multiply that across the different channels. But then, you know, the wheels come off that because of the constraints that those standards don't support. And as people move forward, they want to have, like, Samsung's good for that. They want to have their own standards when it comes to their own operating system. So I think it's difficult. I think if you look at a multi-channel or omni-channel approach to any business, and every business is going to have similar issues, then the investment in that channel has to pay off in the long run. And I think that's why you're not seeing a lot of depth and capability with the watch device, for example. So I don't think Spotify, as an example, see that there's such a broad market there that they really need to invest however many millions of dollars into making sure that that app is up to date and working properly and continues to be working that way.
Not yet, but like everything with technology, there's a tipping point, and it will come. Because one of the things that I didn't realize until I actually had a watch was it does actually open up a whole different way of experiencing technology. So as somebody who's been a technologist for, as you said, over 30 years, I have been accused of being a little bit too obsessed with screens and being on either my computer or my phone a lot. So what I realize is with the watch, I can put all my screens away, and I know that I can get to any of the information if I really need to, but it's not as easy or as necessarily as pleasant as it is on other devices, but in a strange kind of way, that opens me up to a certain kind of freedom. So I'm still connected and I can still get all the main things that I need, but I don't have to worry about my technology as much. I'm not thinking about it, because, you know, watches are so addictive. Yeah. Sorry. You know that phones are so addictive. Watches are much less addictive,
yeah,
because you've got to sort of look in this tiny little thing on your hand, and if your eyes aren't that of a 18-year-old, that can be in itself not the most pleasant experience. So it's interesting to see how that's sort of shifting the way we interact. So in recent times in my life, I'm using both voice and watch. And in doing so, I can spend a lot more time being present with human beings, which I didn't even think about until that happened. So that's one of the many benefits of modernization, I suppose, getting rid of the... It's not just the technical debt, it's also innovation and moving forward.
Yeah.
Once again, it's been wonderful chewing the fat with you, young man. Adios, amigo.
Ciao.